Stanley Tookie Williams was put to death sometime after 12:01 a.m. on the evening of Monday night, the 12th, the morning of Tuesday, December 13th, 2005, before thousands and thousands of people in the crowd that had gathered throughout the night to oppose the death penalty in general and to oppose specifically Tookie Williams' execution on the basis of problems within his case and his argument of innocence, as well as the question of guilt or innocence aside, his redemption and rehabilitation within prison, the presumption that he had done his time, paid his debt, moved on, and was a productive member of society, more so alive than dead. So the crowd that gathered may not have agreed on why they were there, but they gathered outside. We gathered outside to bear witness to the execution, to express our discontent with this aspect and many others of the system, to express our opposition to the execution of Stan Tookie Williams by the state of California on December 13th, 2005.
This is the declaration of Gordon Bradbury von Ellerman. I, Gordon Bradbury von Ellerman, declare as follows. Number one, I am a 46 California identification number N541-2882, residing in the city of Los Angeles, and am a United States citizen. On December 8, 2005, I left a telephone message at the Compton office of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, hereinafter named NAACP, regarding information that I have that may be relevant to the innocence of Stanley Tookie Williams. On December 9th, 2005, at approximately 5 p.m., I was contacted by private investigator Michelle Gandy in response to the message I left with the NAACP. My call to the NAACP was prompted by my having read an article in the December 8th, 2005 edition of the Daily Breeze, which referred to an individual by the name of George Oglesby, who had testified against Mr. Williams at trial. Number five, while incarcerated at Los Angeles County Jail in 1979 through 1980, I was for approximately 6 months a cellmate of George Oglesby, who I knew as Roger Oglesby and referred to as Gunner. Number six, during a portion of that time period, both Mr. Oglesby and I were trustees at the jail, which entitled us to certain rights and privileges, including periodic release from our cells and access to other parts of the jail to assist deputies with tasks such as food and mail distribution. It was during this time that I met Mr. Williams, who was incarcerated in a jail cell, in a jail tier, adjacent to where Mr. Oglesby and I were housed. Number eight, during my incarceration with Mr. Oglesby, I personally observed a sequence of events wherein Los Angeles Sheriff's Department personnel delivered to Mr. Oglesby copies of documents relating to various criminal cases, including police reports specifically relating to the prosecution of Mr. Williams, which I personally read. In my conversations with Mr. Oglesby, he told me that he intended to use information in these reports for the purpose of testifying against Mr. Williams and others, claiming he would do this in order to gain a reduction or elimination of charges pending against him. Number 10, I specifically recall him telling me that he was, quote, gonna put that nigger away, unquote, and that, quote, that shotgun crip is gonna do the time, referring to Mr. Williams. On numerous occasions, I observed Mr. Oglesby with handwritten kites that he claimed came from Mr. Williams that he had failed to deliver and was instead using as a model to practice replicating Mr. Williams' handwriting. He told me he was doing this so that he could create incriminating documents that would appear to have been written by Mr. Williams. I also found remnants of his practice kites in the garbage in our cell on multiple occasions. Number 12, when I use the word kite, I am referring to any transfer of information between inmates that you don't want authorities to find out about. During this period of time in which I was incarcerated in the Los Angeles County Jail, it was common practice from my observation for inmates to testify against other inmates in order to obtain a benefit in their own case. And I was personally aware that Los Angeles Sheriff's Department personnel would often provide information to these inmates so that they could help frame defendants for crimes. My decision to contact the NAACP at this time was motivated because I just learned for the first time through reading the subject news article that Mr. Oglesby had in fact testified in the case against Mr. Williams. I'm a Christian and I felt a moral and spiritual imperative to relay this information, as I am aware that Mr. Williams is awaiting execution and I believe that he may in fact be innocent of these charges and that a gross miscarriage of justice may be occurring. Also incarcerated in our tier during this time were Jay Williams, Mitchell Kane, Michael Stevens, and George Jorge Abreu, all of whom I believe would have information corroborating my assertions herein. This declaration was prepared with the assistance of attorneys Michael L. Becker, State Bar Number 165145, and Eric J. Feig, State Bar Number 169952, and Private Investigator Michelle Gandy, PI Number 17822. This declaration is based on my interview with said attorneys and investigator, and I have thoroughly read and reviewed this declaration and confirmed the accuracy of the contents herein. The above declaration is true and correct under penalty of perjury pursuant to the laws of the state of California, executed this 10th day, December 2005, in Los Angeles, California. Gordon Bradbury, Barnum.
And I would just ask one final question of you with regard to this declaration. If called upon to testify in open court, would you be willing to come into court and testify consistent with the contents of this declaration?
Yes, I would.
Would you be willing to? Would you be willing to be subjected to cross-examination by prosecutors or others, judges, with regard to the information here?
I'm willing to tell anybody this information.
Despite this evidence and more, and despite the inspiration that Stan Tookie Williams put forth and offered to thousands, perhaps millions, of young people to avoid the gang life, to turn away from the gang life. Despite all this, again, yesterday, on this particular, the date of this particular broadcast, Stanley Tookie Williams was put to death by the state of California. Now, when his execution date was put forth, two other dates were put forth. Clarence Ray Allen is scheduled to die next month. And not many people are aware of his case. Stanley Tookie Williams became a national and international story as Austrians are now outraged at Arnold Schwarzenegger's act, his first actual killing, not a filmed killing, not a the killing of an alien predator or Colombian gorilla, but in fact the killing of an actual human being off camera. This was a huge focal point, and on my way to the execution at San Quentin, in the car on the way there, I heard corporate media, KCBS, reporting on it, and their lead, their context for the story, reporting just hours before his execution was that the cause celebrate for the anti-death penalty movement was about to be extinguished as Stanley Tookie Williams was about to die. No matter what the Hollywood liberals say, no matter what the trendy cause of the moment, according to corporate media, was, it didn't matter. It was about to be over because they were going to kill Stanley Tookie Williams. But people were challenged who were at the gates of San Quentin. People will be challenged in the coming month to oppose the death penalty for a new death row inmate who is scheduled to die again January 17th, just a few weeks away, again at San Quentin in the state of California, United States of America, planet Earth. Clarence Ray Allen, a Choctaw Indian, will turn 76 years old the day before his scheduled execution. He will turn 76 on January 16th, 2006. He is scheduled to die January 17th, 2006, the day after his 76th birthday. Forgive me for repeating myself, but this is incredible to me. If this execution is carried out, Allen will be the oldest man to be put to death in the U.S. in over 60 years. Allen is in very poor health, suffering from advanced heart disease and diabetes. He is confined to a wheelchair and is legally blind. He suffered a major heart attack on September 2nd of this year, 2005. He has been nearly discipline-free for the past 23 years. I'm reading from deathpenalty.org, a fact sheet on Clarence Ray Allen, the website of Death Penalty Focus. Clarence Ray Allen was convicted in 1982 for ordering the murders of three individuals while already serving a life sentence at Folsom State Prison for the murder of a young woman in 1974. The man who actually perpetrated the three murders also received a death sentence. His name is Billy Hamilton. The Superior Court set Allen's execution date again on January 17th. After the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals denied Allen's pending petition for relief. On October 3rd of this year, in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court denied Allen's request for relief. Issues in the case. His prosecution depended on the testimony of unreliable informant witnesses. Allen is a Native American while all his victims are white, and this case was tried in a rural, predominantly white county. Allen had an ineffective, poorly qualified lawyer, such that the Ninth Circuit actually said in their opinion denying Allen relief, which is unfortunately often the case. As people are given appeals, the court puts forth these amazing statements of support for the problems with the case. Courts will put in their decision denying an appeal, denying clemency, denying further redress, the most amazing statements that corroborate the what is put forth by the defense in order to stop the execution. They'll corroborate everything, but still deny an appeal. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said in their opinion denying Allen relief, quote, trial counsel admits he did nothing to prepare for the penalty phase after the guilty verdicts were rendered, and even then, in what little time was available, he failed sufficiently to investigate and adequately present available mitigating evidence. The Ninth Circuit states that it is, quote, overwhelmingly plain that trial counsel's performance, quote, fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. They also found a series of, the Ninth Circuit, also found a series of errors committed by the trial court, prosecutor, and defense counsel in this case. For example, the judge gave the jury the wrong instructions on the law, stating, quote, if you conclude that the aggravating evidence outweighs the mitigating evidence, you shall return a death sentence. This misled the jury, wrongly mandated that the jury return a death sentence without regard to their personal views. The Ninth Circuit also found that the prosecutor committed misconduct several times in closing argument at both the guilt and the penalty phases, and in addition, the jury should have considered only three aggravating factors but mistakenly considered 11 aggravating factors. On this issue, the Ninth Circuit stated in its denial of relief, quote, no one disputes that the trial court erred. How can we execute Allen while the Justice Commission investigates these issues? Because the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice has been established to study exactly these kinds of mistakes. The Justice Commission must report its recommendations to the governor and legislature by the end of the year 2007. No one should be executed while the Justice Commission is conducting this in-depth study. And yet, Clarence Ray Allen is scheduled to die the day after his 76th birthday. I'm reading from Reuters. The execution of Stanley Tookie Williams has put the spotlight on a campaign by opponents of the death penalty for state legislation that would temporarily halt capital punishment in California. Assemblyman Paul Koretz said on Tuesday that he would renew a push for a bill he introduced earlier this year that calls for a moratorium until January 1st, 2009, so this committee that I mentioned can investigate whether California's justice system sends innocent people to death row. Additionally, this in his appeals case, the Federal Appeals Court, now I am reading from sfgate.com, the San Francisco Chronicle's website, an article from earlier today, December 14th, says, after Williams, headline, after Williams, a new dilemma for governor next, gravely ill and blind man, 75, scheduled to die. a little ways down. This is the most important part here. The federal appeals court said that by attacking witnesses, quote, Allen struck the greatest blow possible upon our criminal justice system. The judges also noted that Allen had expressed no remorse for the crimes. Same argument they used for Tookie. Allen's lawyers say the bulk of evidence against him at trial came from witnesses who were informants, and that three of them have since recanted their testimony. Same as Tookie. Their request for clemency, however, is similar to the failed bid that attorneys for Williams made shortly before he was put to death, namely, that the state has nothing to gain by carrying out the execution. Now, what I want to mention here is that the federal appeals court said that by attacking witnesses, Allen struck the greatest blow possible upon our criminal justice system. Now, this is certainly a valid point in a different system. I completely understand what they're saying, that from prison, he ordered the execution, supposedly, of witnesses against him in trial. Now, the sanctity of the trial or of the safety of witnesses, etc. You know, we've all seen the mafia movies about executing the witnesses so you can get off, etc. That's the point they're making, and I understand that. However, I don't know if that's the greatest blow possible upon our criminal justice system. I think that executing an innocent person, perhaps, is a greater blow upon the criminal justice system. I think that incompetent counsel, incompetent defense, is perhaps the greatest blow upon our criminal justice system. I think that the denial to recognize treaties is perhaps the greatest blow possible upon our criminal justice system. I think that perhaps executing mentally retarded people, executing blind, wheelchair-bound senior citizens is perhaps a greater blow to our criminal justice system. And as this country has executed people who were represented by attorneys, public defenders, because they were too poor to afford high-profile defense lawyers, people are given a public defender. I don't want to be misquoted here. Public defenders are noble people who do their job well. But public defenders who have never won a death penalty case and yet take a death penalty case, public defenders who admit to doing cocaine during the trial, public defenders who have fallen asleep during the trial of their defendants, public defenders who do absolutely no research and make no attempt to understand the difference between a capital case and a life imprisonment penalty phase is completely different. And we have public defenders, again, this is proven fact, public defenders who are defending death row inmates who are doing coke, falling asleep, and who are completely unprepared for court. This is not a criminal justice system. This is a feeder system directly into the prison industrial complex. This is not justice. This cannot be called justice in any way. Like I said earlier, you can oppose one particular case. You can oppose the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams because it appears that he was innocent of the crimes or that he was convicted of committing because of evidence that wasn't presented, because of the obvious bias of the LAPD against a admitted gang member. People say that if he didn't deserve to die for the crimes that he was convicted of, he deserved to die for other crimes that he certainly committed. Well, this creates a problem when you have a corrupt police force. This creates a problem when you understand the history of the Crips. CRIP stands for Common Revolution in Progress, and it was founded as a revolutionary organization dedicated to organizing young men in the community to defend their community against a racist, violent police force that was dedicated, that was absolutely mandated to control neighborhoods of color. So there's a certain reason for the LAPD, for the powers that be, for the juvenile justice system, for the court system, to put forth whatever was necessary to put forth to put Stanley Tookie Williams behind bars. And that's exactly what we heard when we heard the deposition earlier that was given by Mr. Von Ellerman. who was in jail with Stanley Tookie Williams and who saw the main witness in the case given case information the night before. He corroborated various stories, various aspects of the police version of story that convicted Stanley Tookie Williams. Furthermore, guilt or innocence aside, the question of rehabilitation, the question of redemption, the question of whether people can be of use in prison. Stanley Tookie Williams, people say, blah, 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 he was writing kids' books, whatever. Okay, he was nominated for the Nobel Prize. Anybody can be nominated for the Nobel Prize. Blah, 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 blah. There are all these arguments. There's all this stuff out in mainstream discourse that makes absolutely no sense if you question the cost of executing someone rather than incarcerating someone and the value of human life and the value of Stanley Tookie Williams' life. If you talk to people who have read his book, if you talk to people who understand what he was trying to do. The night of the execution at San Quentin, at the gates outside, there were speakers after speakers after speaker after speaker after speaker who put forth arguments about the prison industrial complex and capital punishment as a philosophical idea. A lot of people spoke and they had a lot of really important things to say, but for the most part, they were preaching the converted. However, at the end of the night, toward midnight, as midnight approached in the last half hour or so, as we all were standing there imagining Stanley Tookie Williams being brought into the chamber, being, you know, having his arm wiped, being strapped into the table, the orders being given, the procedure going through to, quote-unquote, humanely kill a human being. We stood outside imagining this, and rather than continue with speaker after speaker after speaker, young people from the crowd came up to the mic and the podium and just passed his book around and read pages almost at random, even repeating it a couple of times, because the young people in the crowd who were there not to oppose the death penalty, but who were there to oppose the killing of someone who was important in their lives. This is an important point. For me, I was there to oppose the death penalty. I was there to bear witness. Stanley Tookie Williams never spoke to me and told me that I needed to change my life and step away from a violent lifestyle. That never happened to me. But some of the people in the audience were touched by his words. Some of the people, not the audience, some of the people in the crowd, some of the people in the group that had assembled outside to make a statement were outside the gates of San Quentin because they absolutely opposed seeing their hero executed. To a privileged straight white male living in Northern California, Stanley Tookie Williams wasn't per se a hero to me, who spoke to me directly. But there are people in the crowd who felt like Stanley Tookie Williams reached out from his death row prison cell and told them specifically, with context from their lives, that they needed to step away from the life that they were seeing in their neighborhood, that they were seeing around them. Those people came up to the microphone at the perimeter of San Quentin Prison in Marin County, California, and read from his work. Talk to each other, talk to us, talk to everyone, in his words, in Tookie's words, in their own, they lent their own voices to Stanley's message. It was incredibly powerful. And as we imagined him being injected with various cocktails of toxic chemicals, shutting down his organs one by one, his words took on an eerie, strange, calming effect, because whenever there was silence, we imagined what was going on. But whenever we heard from Tookie's work, from his autobiography, from his message, there was something else to latch onto besides images of death and execution and murder.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth.
Johnny Cash, The Mercy Seat, Free Radio Santa Cruz. The other execution scheduled in the state of California is Michael Morales, scheduled to die in February. They scheduled 3 executions for 3 consecutive months. Again, I'm reading from deathpenalty.org, the Death Penalty Focus website, a fact sheet on Michael Morales. 45, grew up in San Joaquin County, 4th-generation American, devoutly religious, father of 3 adults, sentenced to death in 1981 for the rape and murder of a 17-year-old, Terry Winchell. Morales was 21 years old at the time of the crime. His co-defendant, Ricky Ortega, who is his cousin, orchestrated the murder, yet Ortega received a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. Morales' request for relief was denied by the Ninth Circuit in March of 2005, and as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court also rejected his appeal in October of this year. This case depends on the testimony, once again, of an unreliable informant witness. The Morales case prominently featured the testimony of a jailhouse informant who claimed that Morales had confessed to him. This purported confession was the only evidence to support the special circumstance, and it was crucial to securing Morales' death sentence. It was later discovered that prior to trial, Morales' prosecutor entered into a secret agreement with the jailhouse informant, Bruce Samuelson, in exchange for his testimony. The prosecutor agreed to dismiss 4 of 6 felony charges pending against Samuelson in another case. The prosecutor also secured court approval of a minimal county jail sentence for Samuelson and then hid this deal from Morales' attorney, the judge, and the jury. Even more disturbing, the prosecutor promised Samuelson these benefits before Morales allegedly confessed to him. When asked on the stand whether he had received anything in return for his testimony, Samuelson falsely stated that his prosecutor would be making only a recommendation on his behalf. The prosecutor let this false testimony stand in front of the jury without correction or clarification. The circumstances surrounding his so-called confession are also questionable. Samuelson was never housed in the same cell with Morales. Given the physical layout of the jail, in order for Morales to confess to Samuelson, other inmates would have heard the conversation, yet no other inmates ever corroborated Samuelson's story. Inmates also knew that guards monitored all of their conversations with an intercom system. He was confronted with these facts, Samuelson, the witness, but he states that he and Morales spoke together in Spanish, so others would not listen in. Unbeknownst to Samuelson, however, the prisoner, Morales, does not speak Spanish. An FBI expert who examined Samuelson's polygraph test later concluded that the test unequivocally established that Samuelson was lying when he said Morales confessed. But the polygraph report that the prosecutor gave Morales' attorneys at the time of the trial claimed that Samuelson, in fact, was telling the truth. Once again, as we've heard time and time again, surprise, race is a factor in this case. The first statewide study of the impact of race and place on death sentencing in California was just released, showing that the race and ethnicity of the victim and the location are in fact the key factors in determining who will be sentenced to death. The study found that those who murder whites are 4 times more likely to receive a death sentence than those who murder Latinos and 3 times more likely to receive a death sentence than those who murder African Americans. The victim in this case, Terry Winchell, is white. In addition, the study finds that those convicted in rural, predominantly white counties like Ventura, where these crimes were tried, are up to 3 times more likely to be sentenced to death as those convicted of similar crimes in diverse urban communities. In addition, the California Attorney General does not dispute that this case, during the 1980s, the San Joaquin District Attorney Office engaged in discriminatory charging practices, seeking the death penalty in white victim cases 20 times more often than in Latino victim cases. Further, the office was 57 times more likely to seek a death sentence for a white female victim. Finally, one California Supreme Court justice concluded that Morales' death sentence should be reversed based on evidence that Ventura County systematically excluded Latinos from serving on juries. Once again, this is a familiar story. Morales had an ineffective, poorly qualified lawyer. This case was tried long before standards were put in place for defense counsel, and Morales' attorney was not sufficiently trained to handle a death penalty case. Several other legal mistakes were made in the case. For example, the judge failed to give any cautionary instructions about the unreliability of testimony of informant witnesses. And once again, as the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice has been established to study exactly these kinds of mistakes, and their recommendation is still, their investigation is still pending. The recommendation will not be finished and presented to the governor and legislature until the end of 2007. No one should be executed while the Justice Commission is conducting this study. Furthermore, the co-defendant, it has never been clear whether Michael Morales or his co-defendant Ricky Ortega played a greater role in causing the death of Terry Winchell. What we do know is that Morales was sentenced to death and Ortega was sentenced to life without parole. Also, more than $80,000 was spent during the penalty phase to defend Ortega, while next to nothing was spent on the penalty phase of Morales' trial. I would urge listeners to check out Death Penalty Focus, other websites online to better understand what all of us with any kind of introspection at all come to understand as a very convoluted debate and media presentation on the death penalty, and to spend some time in the next few days, please, but in the next few weeks, looking at where you stand on this issue. The death penalty cannot be said to do anything other than predominantly kill poor men of color. If you want to argue with that, good luck. As soon as they execute a rich white man, I might change my mind.
Kill the Rich, Anti-Flag, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
101.1.